Okay, so today we're going to be discussing, beginning our discussion of conversion. And what I want to do is to look at this from both a historical and halakhic context. And what I wanted to do for the sake of organization is to begin by looking at conversion in America today. And the next time, I guess in 2 weeks, to begin to talk about conversion in Israel. That's a somewhat simplistic distinction because, as we'll see and as we know, the issues regarding the challenges facing our community with regard to matters of conversion in America are very much tied up to the question of acceptance of these conversions in Israel. So these are not completely distinct issues, but in Israel there's a whole separate set of issues that we'll come to around Olim from questionable Jewish backgrounds. So especially the Russian Jewish community, the Ethiopian Jewish community, so that has that exists in America, but to a far lesser degree, and it's a completely different kind of challenge. So we'll be looking at that, some of the efforts to address that complexity and that situation in Israel. That's what we're looking at moving forward, but today we're going to start with the challenge in America. So we may or may not be familiar with a little bit of the contours of where things have gone, especially over the last decade. So I want to start with a little bit of storytelling and to kind of speak out together some of the developments that have come, that have really come to the fore, because really the last decade in American Jewry, in the Monorthodox community in particular, but I think more broadly than that, has really seen some very significant developments in terms of structures that have been put in place with regard to matters of conversion. But before we come to the last 10 years, let's start with how things existed previously in the 20th century. So conversion in America had been historically somewhat decentralized. Right? A rabbi within a particular community, a potential candidate for conversion would come forward. The rabbi would consider the merits of the particular case sometime, very often in America in particular, but over the course of history, of many such examples, it was for marriage. That was the most common kind of scenario, but there are many other scenarios. No, as many rabbis who are involved in conversion can attest, no two cases are alike. There's no such thing. Every human being is obviously different, but the nuances and the details in every situation need to be looked at independently. But historically, throughout the Orthodox community, that was really very often how things happened. In the Monorthodox community, that was what we followed as well. That was common practice. It was very much local. It was very much dependent on the particular rabbi that was approached. And that rabbi, we know that in order to convert a candidate, there's a requirement of a certain period of study ahead of time. That was handled typically by whichever rabbi or, you know, whatever relationship was there, by a shul or by a particular rabbi, whatever the case was. And then, ultimately, that rabbi would typically would convene a beis din, would convene a group of three male rabbis who halachically would preside over it. Generally speaking, it was the sponsoring rabbi who did much of the work. So the sponsoring rabbi is, let's say, the local shul rabbi or what have you, who would work with the candidate, who would suggest reading material, who would check in on a very regular basis, either himself study with this individual or set up the candidate to with another, with a tutor, with an individual in the community. Sometimes there are classes, but more commonly it's with individual candidates, and that's how things, generally speaking, were organized. Depending on who you ask, either 10 years ago or 20 years ago, things began to change. And there are a number of things, and depending on who you ask, because there's been some internal rabbinic disagreement as to what the narrative is and what has happened with regard to American conversion. Some would say 20 years ago already, there was increasing concern among members of the Orthodox rabbinate that some of the conversions that were being performed were not necessarily in accordance with the highest of halachic standards. Some would say that they could have been held to higher standards. Others would say that some of the conversions were being performed were even questionable. And in particular, the question that we're going to have to look at today and then into the next classes as well is the question of the acceptance of mitzvot. Because this really is the crux. We know that there are a number of elements that are necessary for a proper conversion. There is, for males, is a circumcision piece. For males and females, there's an immersion piece. Go to the mikvah. That's certainly a piece of it. But those are typically not the sticking points. You know, the matter of immersion, unfortunately, since a recent very publicized scandal has become a sensitive one, and that's just you know, that's deeply distressing, and we touched on this during our rabbinic scan, during our studying from disgraced rabbis discussion. So that's been back in the news, but in terms of, you know, historically, what were sort of the challenges that were facing conversion, it was really the question of the acceptance of mitzvot, right? Sort of the essential, you know, question or issue. Because let's say we take for granted, and we'll see that this is some question, but let's assume that as part of the conversion process, a convert needs to commit to follow the mitzvot. Let's assume that that's the case. Now, how do we define a commitment to follow the mitzvot fully? Because I don't know about you, but I have not yet met a human being, right, any Jew that I know, who fully follows every single commandment, right? I'm still waiting. The Gemara says there were four people who were quote-unquote perfect, or without sin, in the history of Judaism, if not humanity. Four people, right? And even then, right, those four people were probably not the greatest of four people, right? For example, Moshe's father is listed, right? Amram is listed as one of the people who never sinned, never touched the taste of sin, right? Now, who is greater, would you say? Moses, right? Moshe's father or Moshe himself?
Sure, right?
Well, that's a little curious, but after all, his father never sinned, right? So if you go up to the heavens and you look at the scorecard, right? It's a perfect game, right? So since we're in the sports, talking about sports earlier, right? It's, right, 27 batters are up, right? Israel, right? If people know, Israel won. It's a very important baseball game. They just won an international competition tournament and a major victory.
And yesterday, Kohelet won
the Tier 4
at the Saracek tournament.
Saracek tournament.
Basketball.
Very, very high. Well done. So many milestone victories.
Yes.
So Moshe Rabbeinu. Right. Presumably, according to Jewish tradition, was greater than his father. Well, what gives? Right. What gives?
Context.
Right. Context?
Context is everything. It is a lot, in my opinion.
Okay. What do you mean context?
In the sense that if you're talking about Moshe and his father, that's wonderful that his father was perfect in following the mitzvot. But it was only it was restricted, shall we say, to a personal level, because nobody ever knows what he did publicly. Whereas Moshe, even if he sinned, in certain technical ways, which cost him tremendously, was an extraordinary leader for the Jewish people. Right. So historically, he's much more significant. Spiritually, he's much more significant.
Right, absolutely. Now, I'd only add, the fact that Moshe sinned is intrinsically tied up to his public leadership.
Right.
So in other words, as soon as a person steps into the limelight, the pitfalls are endless, and it is almost inevitable that such a person at some one point or another, even in smaller ways or in larger ways, will stumble, which doesn't excuse it, but still, it's just part of leadership. So Moshe's father, yes, he stood out of the limelight. His job was to pass the torch to the next generation, pass the baton forward, and that's fine, but Moshe was in a more of a public position. So in other words, the fact that someone has not sinned does not necessarily make that person greater than all others in the generation. And so it's inevitable that as soon as we engage in the world and as soon as we're out there, we're going to sin. So what does it mean, to come back to the question of conversion, what does it mean for a convert to be fully committed to a lifestyle of Torah and mitzvot? And the standards of halachic practice differ from community to community. So if I'm here in, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, let's say, for example, right, the standards of what's, and I'm a typical member of a particular local modern Orthodox synagogue. Well, the standards of what constitutes commitment to halachic practice might look very different than they do to a Haredi judge in Ramat Beit Shemesh Bet or something like that, or Me'esh Arm or what have you. Right, Petach Tikva, just to take some actual cases, right? So, if I'm living embedded in a certain kind of community and I see a certain kind of lifestyle that a person committed to, it might not meet the standards that I uphold for conversion or for halachic practice, and I might conclude that this does not constitute normative practice. Whereas if I go to the local rabbi would say, that's what it looks like in my community. That is, right? That's what practice is. And so the question of what constitutes a halachic commitment to live such a lifestyle becomes inherently community dependent, depends on a certain degree of cultural awareness or sensitivity, and it's not necessarily going to look the same in every single place. Be that as it may, that inherent ambiguity in terms of what constitutes halachic commitment at certain points leaves open the possibility for even lesser standards, because then if it could look like anything, then it can look like anything. And there became increasing concern among the American rabbinate that there were individual rabbis who were going out and performing conversions that would not necessarily be acceptable to their colleagues. So already in something like 1989, there was the first internal conversation within the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the largest single umbrella group of Orthodox rabbis in the United States. Already at this point, well over 1,000 members, and already internal conversations with regard to this question: how do we handle this sensitive issue? For whatever set of reasons, there was not necessarily public action that was taken, there was nothing that was put in place. So that was sort of step one or stage one. Number of years later, fast forwarding to the first decade of the new millennium, basically, in other words, around 2005, 2006, all of a sudden, we have a new set of challenges. We have now the issue of the challenge of converts traveling to Israel, and either the chief rabbinate institutionally, or as often, if not more often than not, local individual rabbis who are members of the chief rabbinate, but honestly, the chief rabbis of Israel, might be a city based in or what have you. Again, I mentioned Petach Tikva as an example. There are other local cities where conversions had been questioned. And what happened in some cases is that there is the horrific and tragic situation of a convert or the child of a convert, the grandchild of a convert coming forth simply asking for recognition, perhaps completely innocent and not even aware of what was coming down the pike, and then all of a sudden they presented their conversion papers or their story, and it was rejected out of hand. And we know that many of us may be familiar firsthand, second, or what have you, some of the challenges that converts can face in our community and community. In addition to that, the Torah is extremely stringent with regard to the matter of relating in a respectful, sensitive way to the gerim and to a whole range of individuals in the community. And 36 times this Torah puts out this prohibition because there are certain individuals who, for whom there might be an additional a challenge in terms of the community engaging with sensitivity and acting in an inappropriate fashion. And so these are just outright apparent violations of 36 very stringent laws in the Torah. This is extremely serious stuff. And what happened was the converts were being caught in the middle. And so the Rabbinical Council of America spoke to the chief rabbinate, and the chief rabbinate doubled down. They were not willing to automatically recognize any American rabbi because they said, who knows if this is... And the RCA itself, or members of the RCA, had questioned certain conversions within their own community, right? So there were rabbis back in as early as 1989 whose conversions were being questioned internally by members of the Rabbinical Council of America, so they could not go in good conscience to the chief rabbinate and say, well, any American person who calls themselves rabbi, automatically you have to accept this conversion. First of all, there was the matter of reform and conservative conversions, which itself was a challenge. The Orthodox rabbis, in difficult circumstances, would not be able to accept such a conversion. And then on top of that, you had even Orthodox rabbis who were performing conversions that were viewed as questionable. And so the converts were the ones who suffered the cost. And that's, in the end, that's what so much of this is about, is how to have that sensitivity and how to build structures in place to protect vulnerable individuals and protect converts in our community. So the RCA did their research, and they basically struck a deal with the chief rabbinate. A deal with the chief rabbinate, and the plan was that they would now centralize conversion. They would centralize conversion. Now, the RCA insisted that the primary motivation was for internal American reasons, because you have these rogue rabbis who are performing questionable conversions. Of course, others accused them of saying, no, really all you're doing is you're buckling to the pressure from the chief rabbinate. You're allowing these right-wing rabbis who don't understand the first thing about the American Jewish community to dictate to us the terms of our conversion. Right, so that became the back and forth. The RCA responded and said, number one, no, that was not the primary impetus. And number two, more than that, right, our goal is to protect the converts. Because if it's a wild west of conversion and anything can happen, then what's going to happen is that's going to create a scenario in which converts are going to be vulnerable. But if we can come to an agreement with the chief rabbinate and say, we now have a centralized system that you signed off on, so it may make things more difficult, it may make local rabbis feel questioned, but what we have done is we've said, now we have a system in place where any convert who goes through the RCA system, what they call the GPS, Geros, right, Hebrew for conversion, policies and standards, I think, the system, right, of Bate Din in this conversion process, if you've gone through this process, we have a commitment 100% from the chief rabbinate that these conversions will be accepted. So that was the response.
So they still would go through the process with their local rabbi, but then added on top of that.
That's right.
Would be
The local rabbi would still be the sponsoring rabbi, but instead of the local rabbi convening a Beis Din, the local rabbi would then immediately not turn the case over, but be in consultation with a regional court. This is how it's structured. This is one in New York. There's one in L.A. There's one in the Washington, D.C. area, and so on and so forth. And so you would go, and you would turn the case over and ask and say, I can vouch for this convert at this point. Is this a case that you would consider? Uh-huh. Okay, and the basin would have a meeting with the candidate and ask about the case and say, this is a case that we can consider or we cannot consider. And then assuming they said that they can consider the case, the rabbi would continue studying with the candidate, or again, having someone else studying with the candidate and be the support and to be available, etc. Continue close communication and then sort of walk the candidate through the process. Now, inevitably what happens with the centralization of a process or the bureaucratization, I guess, of the process, I think that's a word. There's a double-edged sword there, because on the one hand, it creates real standards, or strict standards. On the other hand, it creates strict standards. And now what you have is essentially a two-tiered system. And you have both the GPS system in place, which many rabbis avail themselves of, and there are the same rabbis sometimes, or other rabbis, will also work outside of that system. Now, the challenge, right, and why would they work outside of that system? Because there are some rabbis who believe that the current system is just right. There are other rabbis who believe that it is too strict, right, is the standards are too high. Again, others will respond, well, it needs to be high so that it's accepted by the rabbi, and the other rabbis will say, okay, that's fine, but you have situations of real people who are desperate to convert. Not every case is in the box. There are many cases that are out of the box. And if we create too standardized sort of a scenario, there are people who are going to suffer. There are people who are good candidates for conversion. So this is kind of the back and forth. And what you have now is these two tiers. You know, what you've had even more recently, because the issues of the rabbinate is questions of, is the rabbinate staying with its agreement? Is it not staying with the agreement? What happens to conversions now and prior that were not done or are not done? That's become a major issue under the GPS system. So this becomes a huge question. So some rabbis have, basically what this is the rabbis who are outspoken on the, I guess, for lack of a better term, on the left on this issues have been, as you might expect, Rabbi Avi Weiss has been very outspoken against, a critic of this system. Also Rabbi Mark Angel, if anyone knows the name. Mark Angel has been, who himself was a past president of the Rabbinical Council of America, has been a vociferous critic of this new system. And there have been a number of individuals from within the Rabbinical Council of America who have responded in a respectful but firm kind of fashion. So that's included Rabbi Shmuel Golden, if anyone knows from Englewood, if anyone's familiar with that name, who's very far, those who know him well, he's very far from being some sort of right-winger. By no stretch of the imagination is that an accurate depiction. But he's someone who's come through his involvement in the Rabbinical Council of America, to appreciate, he's worked closely with many, many converts. He's seen a lot of difficult scenarios in his day, and he's come to the conclusion that this is the best way to ensure their safety. So it's not just some like right wing, left wing. It's more complicated than that. You know, it's a question of institutional versus, you know, establishment versus, you know, anti-establishment or a different approach to the establishment. It's a question of balancing between halachic standards and, you know, and ensuring, you know, that the converts are accepted. And it's a question of what is kindness to the converts in our communities look like. Is it giving them the option, or is it giving them clear standards that they can rely on, that they know will always be accepted?
Can you talk a little bit about the concept of retroactively invalidating a conversion? Because from a halachic perspective, I mean, I think if you could, I mean, I think there's kind of two ways. I mean, I think if it's clear that it never was done properly to begin with, and we could take an extreme example, it's non-Orthodox conversion to avoid, you know, the discussion about what's proper Orthodox conversion, you know, then it's sort of like, I guess it's more like an annulment. It just never existed.
Right.
But if it existed, how do you retroactively undo it?
There is no such thing as a retroactive annulment of a conversion, period, end of story, doesn't exist. Now, in halacha, it doesn't exist.
In politics, it does.
Well, so what's happened is two things. One is you have a series of cases that have come before Israeli rabbis in particular. And by the way, to be clear, it's not just, you know, certain rabbis. You know, Rabbi Lookstein had some of his conversions questioned very, very publicly. Not the Ivanka Trump conversion, but because it was another convert who was done under, converted under Rabbi Lookstein, so then the press started with the Ivanka questions. And the chief rabbi, by the way, that was a good example also where people from outside of Israel don't know the inside there, tend to just conflate, oh, the chief rabbinate. If you look at the American press, especially the non-Orthodox American press, there's sometimes a tendency to say the chief rabbis. And the chief rabbis is as much as saying, you know, it's like saying Lower Merion decided. You know, like the Lower Merion Jewish community decided. I mean, what does that even mean, right? That's, you know, like any organization or group of people or community, the chief rabbinate is comprised of chief rabbis and the whole group of employees of the chief rabbinate, and then there are regional batei din, and there are city batei din, and so on, and there are local towns, and it's not the case at all that every single case has been rejected by the chief rabbinate. In fact, the Rabbi Lookstein case is a good example. There was an individual rabbi who disqualified the conversion, and the chief rabbis of Israel, in particular Ashkenazic chief rabbi Rabbi Lau, which is confusing because both current chief rabbis are children of previous chief rabbis. That's a whole other discussion. But Rabbi Lau stood by Rabbi Lookstein's conversions. But it's not just Rabbi Lookstein or someone who's sometimes perceived by some as being, you know, maybe a little bit more to the modern end of the Orthodox community. But recently there was a story with some extremely established, well-respected rabbis whose earlier conversion, and in other words, more within the right end of the YU world, people like Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who's an Av based in Chicago, an extremely well-recognized posek across the Orthodox community in America by, you know, pretty much all standards. Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who's certainly not known as a liberal in modern Orthodox circles. They had cases that were pre-GPS. Those were also questioned by individual, it's not just being limited to a certain subset of rabbis. It's really a challenge in terms of the recognition of rabbis, as a lack of cultural familiarity. There have been many calls for transparency, you know, those kinds of things. But just to come back to the question, make sure I've answered it fully, there is no such thing as the annulment of the retroactive annulment of conversion. There are two things. You can either question whether or not the conversion itself was done properly, or you can question the bona fides, the Orthodox bona fides of the converting rabbi. And that happened not to American rabbis, but there's a very prominent Israeli modern, you know, Dati Lumi, Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, who converted many, many Russians. And there was a Haredi Rav who said that not only were these conversions disqualified, but he himself apparently is not qualified as an Orthodox rabbi, and therefore every single one of his conversions is questionable, if not outright disqualified. And there's a Rabbi Sherman who came up with this psak. And he's a very big Talmud Chacham who's coming from a very, very right-wing background. And this is, frankly, completely unacceptable and despicable behavior. And I say that on the record, and I'm far from the first one to say so. The rabbi that he defamed is not only of the foremost ethical caliber, but is a first-rate Torah scholar by all measures. It's unconscionable that such a person would, if he can't convert anyone, there's, you know, maybe, you know, a dozen people living in the world who are halakhically qualified, and just on terms of scholarship alone to convert people. It's really, completely unacceptable and just absurd. You want to disagree with someone, that's one thing. There are real ramifications in terms of conversion. You know, you can try to be strict, but every stringency, of course, is leniency, right? Because you're telling people that had been told that they were Jewish that they're not. So it's certainly a complex matter to question a conversion, but to then say that retroactively every conversion is disqualified for someone who's completely qualified to do so is just a horrible, horrible thing.
So what happens really then in that case where one rabbi claims another rabbi is no longer valid? Who mediates such
a... Usually, this is a great question. Usually in Israel, most commonly these things are in Israel because America is just a more decentralized situation. I mean, if you think about the American Jewish community in general, it's an incredibly decentralized model. There are benefits and challenges to that. And, you know, conversion to centralized conversion was highly controversial because it's so countercultural for us. But in Israel, so in America, usually it's not an issue because it's handled on a local level. I've heard stories of people who couldn't find communities that would accept a particular conversion or choose to convert them. And they literally went wandering from community to community before they could find someone to accept them, accept their children to day school or to convert them so that their children go into day school. So those are huge challenges here. But in Israel, it goes ultimately to the chief rabbis. In all these instances that I've seen, at least in the end of the day, the chief rabbis of Israel have endorsed these conversions, to the best of my knowledge, across the board. So that has not remained the issue, but yeah.
So is it fair to assume that, number one, it's easier if it's a man's conversion that is questioned? Because if the woman is Jewish, according to Orthodoxy, the child is Jewish, so it's less of a problem in terms of day school and all sorts of stuff.
In terms of children, right. Sometimes these families have adopted children, in which case the conversion question arises nonetheless.
But could the child go to mikvah and stuff like that, and can't the child be... converted on its own?
For sure. That's when we talk next week about the Israel side, but we're going to talk about converting...
The week after.
Next class, we're going to talk about converting children. And that has a different set of questions, and that's what they attempted to do to solve the Russian issue.
And halakhically speaking, I don't even know how to frame the situation. What I'm trying to ask is, if a woman and a man are so in love, etc., they're just going to be together, period, the end. Is it halachically more acceptable, and the man is not going to convert, or the man is gets a conversion, but it's not acceptable by mainstream Orthodox standards?
Mm-hmm.
So is it better for them... Not even to go through. Is it better for the man not to even go through the process of trying to convert if it's not going to be acceptable? And they just live together, and whatever the consequences are, in our society that tends to be a mm-hmm. little more acceptable.
Right.
Again, because the mother's Jewish, the child is Jewish, and kachase. So is it less problematic for to get for a man to get a conversion that's not acceptable, or for them just to stay Jewish woman, non-Jewish man, but the children are Jewish?
Are they asking for the sake of marriage, or not even that? That's not even what you're saying. They're already together.
If they can't get married orthodoxly.
But the question you're asking is about the... So in terms of the marriage piece, there's a difference between the Ashkenazic classic general practice and Sephardic general practice, with the exception of the Syrian community and some others. So many of us might be familiar with that, that the Syrian American community at least has accepted a takana that they do not convert. And the converts are not generally welcome in their community.
Very strict.
Probably was born of early 20th century dynamics in the American community. Whether or not those dynamics are still in play 80 years later is a question. In general, Ashkenazim have ruled a little bit more stringently and tend not to convert for marriage, whereas Sephardim generally do. Or historically have to a larger degree. This has also manifested itself in Israel. We'll come probably next time to Rav Uziel, the first Rishon Zion, first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. He was more receptive to converting, even without full commitment to mitzvot, and that was part of this greater leniency. Rabbi Mark Angel, who is of Sephardic background, who was the rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese synagogue in New York, he has trumpeted and championed the Sephardic approach and suggested that maybe it even be adopted more mainstream. But that's part of where he's coming from historically in terms of the tradition that he's drawing upon. Ashkenazic rabbis say that's okay, so that's fine, but that's not our tradition. By your own analysis is counter to that. But
is it the Dieved?
The Dieved, everyone would agree that, and it's very clear in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and Shulchan Aruch, etc., that even if the impetus was for the sake of marriage, if we conclude that there is a genuine halachic commitment, even if the initial motivation was for the sake of marriage, that once such a conversion was performed, that it is accepted. If there's still a question as to whether or not the motivation spilled over into the content or the substance of the commitment, that becomes more complicated. But if it's a pure question of motivation, then we do accept it post facto. Okay. We're not going to read everything here, but I gave you plenty of reading material for at home, but I've touched on a lot of these things. One thing, there was an organization called EJF, Eternal Jewish Family, someone by the name of Leib Tropper, who was involved in that. And there was an unfortunate scenario involving him, and that led to some of the conversations in the GPS and all of that. But I gave you an article from the RCA website, that's number one here, and this kind of outlines the thinking behind the establishment about a year before of the GPS system, and they sort of give a sense as to how things are structured. A much more recent response by Rabbis Weiss and Angel, that's on page 3. This initially appeared, as you see, in the Jerusalem Post, and they pushed back against the RCA after there were questions raised about acceptance of conversions in Israel. So you have that. And then you have a response by Rabbi Golden. This starts at the bottom of page 4, it's source number 3. This is published as a Times of Israel op-ed or blog post by Rabbi Golden, as well as Rabbi Mentanki. Rabbi Lani Mentanki, those who know the name, is the rabbi. He's the principal of Ida Crown in Chicago, and he's the rabbi of, I think, probably the largest non-Orthodox shul there. That's in West Rogers Park there, and this is their response. And again, one of the points of emphasis is that you claim that by decentralizing conversion, we will better protect the converts. We maintain that the opposite is true, that by centralizing the system, we actually best ensure the acceptance of converts and that they don't find themselves in very difficult scenarios at a later point. Then there was a recent protest after the conversion performed by Eluxstein was questioned. He got together with someone who's not generally known as a great halachic decisor, but a great Jew, Natan Sharansky, and they protested together how Natan Sharansky became involved in halachic standards for conversion. I'm not sure, but as a Russian Jew, obviously, this is very close, near and dear to his heart, and it's been a major issue.
And
the head of the Jewish agency.
His wife is from
Avital. Right, absolutely. So this is a write-up of their recent protest about these issues. So there's plenty for you to read over, chew on, discuss at your dinner table, at your Shabbos table, and such. But beware, these tend to be, use caution at your own discretion.
The broadest interpretation that I have heard, it's not halachic, it's cultural, but I found something to just to think about. Mm-hmm. This person said, and he's a well-known Jewish authority. Look, he said it publicly, Daniel Hartman, not exactly a posek, but you understand. I just happened to hear him say, he said, anybody who wants to throw his faith with the Jewish people should be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was an off-the-cuff remark in a lecture on something else.
Mm-hmm.
But what do people think about that?
I mean, in the halakhic community,
in the halakhic community, that doesn't hold any water.
I wouldn't say it holds no water.
So
I would say it's a significant. But we're going to talk about talk a little bit about that today. We're going to address that as we go along. I will just say that that's reminiscent of half at least of Ruth's statement. Right?
Exactly.
Ruth, when she is choose to convert, she has two things to say.
Right.
Ami, your nation is my nation, and your God is my God. Even if one disagrees with Daniel Hartman and thinks that a full-throated acceptance of mitzvot is essential to conversion, nonetheless, there are many have said, including Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Lichtenstein, my own teacher, and many others have said that the idea of throwing in our fate with the Jewish people as an essential part of the conversion process and as an essential part of what it means to be Jewish is very much what we derive from Ruth. So in other words, one can disagree with Daniel Hartman and not say that simply identifying the Jewish people is itself
insufficient.
Right, can say that it is insufficient, but can still say, I think something very powerful, that it is an integral part of what it means to be part of the Jewish people. And that there's a certain, I think, beauty in that idea.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll do the rest of the time today, and then we'll pick up next time as well, is to begin to examine the halachic sources that bear on this question. There are a number of sources that talk about, that sort of frame attitudes to conversion, and I'm going to be honest and say that some of them are challenging texts. And the reason that they're challenging texts is because they speak, I think we rightly so, speak very often about the remarkable standard that and sort of inspirational model that converts set for our community. I think that's absolutely the correct approach. There are, however, for the sake of disclosure, there are some texts in the Jewish tradition, the Gemara itself, that talk about the challenges that converts pose to the Jewish community. And there's sort of two schools of thought about how to understand these texts. I want to review some of those. So the Gemara in Yevamot in source 6, on top of page 10 right now, the Gemara in Yevamot in Kuftet Amon Bet, 109b, the Gemara there says that, quotes the position of Rabbi Yitzchak. And the Gemara actually goes so far as to say that it quotes a pasuk in Mishlei. If you take a look at the Hebrew, it quotes in the second line, it says, what does it say? Rav Yaroa ki Arev Zar, Ra'a Chara'a Tavolim Kamle Gerim, Le'erveil Shel Tzion, etc. So if you take a look at the English, it says, evil after evil. If you look at the bold in the English, the second section, or third section of the bold, evil after evil will befall those who accept converts. Now, it doesn't say anything ever but against the convert, but it does talk about, right, I think it implies the challenges of conversion in our community. There are, I mentioned the Syrian Jewish community. Chabad also, generally speaking, does not, general practice in Chabad, the best of my understanding, is not to accept converts today. Because the process of conversion is a complex one, and it's exceedingly difficult sometimes to navigate some of the challenges that come up for us as a community. Now, others would call that an abdication and would push back against that. But there is at least a recognition in the Gemara of some of the challenges that we need to face as a people. I'm a big believer that, okay, there are challenges, but we have to face them. But the Gemara does seem to recognize that in the process of accepting conversion, etc., that there are challenges. And I think some of the challenges that we're describing were well understood by the Gemara, and it is true that there can be challenges in this process. Tosfot is concerned about this, however. And I'll summarize for you, just only give you the Hebrew here. But Tosfot on the spot says, well, what does it mean that evil after evil will befall those who accept converts? He says that would imply that we should not accept converts at all. Tosfot says that's not been our tradition. Tosfot is writing in, let's say, in the High Middle Ages, right, in France, in Germany, England, etc. Say that's not the community custom that we know. We generally do accept converts. So what does that mean? So he says that this is particular to a case of someone where we're not sure that the motivation will lead to a halachic lifestyle. It's essentially what Tosos responds. He says, but don't think that that means we should not accept converts, because there are other Gemara that go, as we'll see in a few moments, that go in the opposite direction as well. So Tosos is very troubled. So the Gemara says that there are challenges in the community addressing the situation of converts. And Tosos says, yeah, but don't misread the Gemara or overread the Gemara to say that, don't do that. In other words, Tosos is saying, in his time and in his place, the right practice is to engage with this issue. But he recognizes, and the Gemara recognizes that it can be challenging at times.
And wasn't that even the practice in the time of the Quran? You know,
for sure. We have famous stories of Hillel we're going to come to.
But there are also, you know, examples within the Gemara of, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's sort of difficult to understand this in the concept of...
That's what Tosos is kind of pointing out. Yeah. That's exactly his point. He cites many Gemaras to that effect. And we're going to, a number of the Gemaras that he cites, we're actually going to see in just a few moments. So absolutely. Now, the Gemara in Kiddushin also is aware of this challenge. The Rabbi Chelvo says that the converts are difficult for the Jewish people. And uses sharp language here, right? As kisapachat. And Tosfot here also is very troubled by this Gemara, and he says, you know, he gives different explanations. One of the things he says it's kasha liYisrael, says Tosfot, not because we don't want to convert, but because the Jewish community has not always been perfect in our ability to stand up and to act in a respectful and sensitive way to the converts. So Tosfos says, you know that pasuk, you know where it says in the Torah that there are the 36 commandments, and there's so many requirements repeated in so many places. Tosfos says, right, he actually says 24, but it's usually counted as 36, but whatever it might be. And Tosfos says, yeah, and that's been a challenge for the Jewish community, because we haven't always held up our end of the bargain properly for those who were born into the Jewish community.
Which is a really interesting question as to what that's about. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've often heard it quoted that, you know, how many times is Shabbos mentioned? And how mm-hmm. many Shabbos labs are there across America? How many times is there love the stranger?
Historically, although there hasn't been a great one in Philadelphia, so I'm going to find out.
How many times are we told to accept... And how difficult is it going back to class at a visceral level? Yeah,
right.
There's sometimes a feeling, a cultural feeling mm-hmm. of non accepting, you know, as a questioning, of, you know,
right.
not knowing how to kind of integrate mm-hmm. and
right.
kind of acclimate people into.
And I think there's a lot of.
It's really an interesting schism.
Yeah. Right, you're saying the discrepancy sometimes between how one of the challenges of Orthodoxy is that we are inclined toward attaching ourselves to ritual obligation, but sometimes in the interpersonal matters, where a fair reading of the Torah demonstrates that we don't have to choose between them, but the Torah made a very big deal out of this and so many other interpersonal obligations. I think as an educational system, it's also something that we really need to think about and really address, whether it be in terms of interpersonal relations, whether it be in terms of business practices, you know, the whole area of interpersonal relation, I think is challenging. And I think you're right. I think it starts with the internal work.
But it's interesting to hear it echoed here.
Yeah.
Its roots are deep. It's not that we come by it honestly. We didn't invent this in the last 20 years. It's not all of a sudden people are uncomfortable.
Right.
You know, there's something here mm-hmm. that's being written, that's being touched on, that's really interesting.
Yeah. And look at it. It goes back in other ways. I mean, not converts, but people who are not necessarily part of the same mainstream of the community. The Erev Rav, going back to when the Jews left Egypt and then blaming it on Nadav and Avihu, and you know,
right.
like that sort of thing. Yeah. Well, there was this other group within. There was a group within a group, and you know, and I do think that those are real challenges. And you're right. There are deep roots to it.
But I guess the question, to try to look at it from the other perspective, I guess the question also becomes one of context. I mean, one would have to think that for, you know, Rabbi Chelvo to have made this comment, that there must have been something going on mm-hmm. in his time
mm-hmm.
involving converts, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't just people becoming gay and wanting to live, you know.
Right, the question is,
what was going on that led him to make a comment.
And I don't know, and I don't know if we have any evidence of that, although I have the people that I can ask, so maybe I'll ask around and see if we can find anything. But it's also, there are two possibilities. One possibility is that maybe there's a group of converts who weren't maintaining that commitment or something like that, or it was from the other side, it was from the community itself, wasn't, right? So he's observing actually about the community, right? That the community isn't up for this somehow. I think that there's one challenge, I don't know if it's this exactly, but I do think that there's a fundamental human tendency to divide ourselves into teams and sort of my group and another group. And I think that it's very deeply seated. I do think that it's Darwinian. We talked about last time. I think it comes from a place of it's a survival tactic. It's how human beings survived and made it through, and I think it's essential to our survival. But it has a very ugly side to it. Even last night, I mean, this is, and it would I don't mean to minimize our conversation, God forbid, by going to sports teams or anything like that. But I say that it was so, as I mentioned, that I took my son to 76ers game last night, and it is striking to me. And you go to soccer games, you can see this, you know, to the nth degree. Or go, you know, they used to have ancient gladiators and, you know, multiply by many times over. But it is so striking to me, this human desire to choose a side.
Right.
Couldn't you imagine sports games where, like, you wouldn't necessarily have to root for someone, where the announcer, whenever, you know, so 76ers against the Milwaukee Bucks. So whenever the Milwaukee Bucks scored, the announcer would say, Sean Long, three-point shot. And whenever the 76ers score, they'd say, you know, like, and right, you know, they whatever it was, and say, a three-point shot for the 76ers defense, like that. You know, and they're tapping into something that is so deep. I mean, the bare-chested men with, you know, for God's sake, the 76ers are like 23-40. I mean, but they still, like, got the name painted, scrawled across their chest. I mean, it's, you know, it's unbelievable. You know, there is this human desire to choose sides. It is us and it is them. That is very deep and is all over in culture forever, from the dawn of humanity. And we take it for granted because we don't even think, because everyone has a sports team that they root for, or, you know. But it's very profound, and I think that I wonder sometimes if that is part of the challenge of how we think about, forget converts for a moment, but think about modern Orthodox and, you know, like this, like we want to think, it's human nature to think in division and not in unity. I have to push back against that. I think it's very, very deep.
If you take any Anthropology 101 course, they'll have a unit on in-group, out-group theory.
It's all this.
And it's all the same thing. Formalized.
Yeah, absolutely. No. Rabbi Sacks summarizes the literature in his book on religious violence, Not in God's Name. He does an excellent job exactly on this kind of stuff, and for the evolutionary stuff. He does a great job of summarizing. It's not his research, obviously, it's not his area, but it's out there, red in tooth and claw.
And we encourage it. Take summer camps, for example. They all have, at least in my day, and I hated it, Cold War.
Yes, schools even do it.
Oh, God. I was just cringed, and I didn't continue to go camp. Unfortunately,
you know what we do? We have schools now have color war, and what we do is we provide other opportunities for students to have other team neutral opportunities. So we have student judges. We have create other opportunities for students who are one. We want to create portals of entry for everyone, but not everyone wants to be on a team.
Right.
And so that's something that's a challenge, and think creatively about how to meet that.
I just wanted to say, I don't disagree with you, but I think here the issue is, there's a fundamental issue of maintaining the integrity of the Jewish religion. It's a real issue.
That's a real issue.
You know, and I think whereas people may have a visceral reaction, there are real issues, and I think Judaism doesn't encourage converts, but but when they do come genuinely, then they should and hopefully are welcome. So that's kind of two different things. You don't want anybody to feel that they can't join without making the proper commitment, and that is a real issue.
Absolutely, of course. I think what Lisa was talking about, when you have a convert who is accepted, and it's not even a question, but the question is, you know, is it natural for our communities to create a comfort level?
Right.
And I think that's what we were talking about. I think that's a real challenge. And yeah, I think that's separate from the question. Of course, in terms of the halakhic questions of acceptance in the first place, is this meet the standards?
Right.
There might be an element of what I'm talking about, but clearly what you're describing is is a major piece of that as well. I mean, there's any question. But I think we were talking about especially.
But I'm saying, I think that reticence to even allow people to cover kind of taking it stage right is because of a broader issue.
Absolutely.
There was a conundrum that I was discussing that I remember, like, growing up, how there was people who converted and like we were taught, you never ask, you right. never talk about, you don't tell the story at a Shabbos table, you never point to.
Mm-hmm.
It was
and
like
that,
it was one of the it was one of the halachas that we were taught that was a halacha and a visceral taboo, like as a child, like you must never kind of thing. And then yet the question becomes, do they ever become part of the community? You know, even with all of those parameters and these wonderful
halachic beautiful things,
the question is, how smooth is that entry? And for many, I know it is not, that I've known personally. Right. And so it's that was what I was speaking of, but excellent point about the integrity.
Yeah, 100%. All right, we are running late. It's about out of time. Let me tell you what we've got coming up in coming attractions. I just described some of the texts that give us some of the challenges, but there are other ones and sort of, you know, wariness around accepting, but there are other texts that cut the other way. So let me do one or two and then we'll call it a day. One very famous one, the Gemara in source number 10, on Shabbat, Lamed Aleph from Aleph, 31a. These are the stories of Hillel and his converts, right? Hillel versus Shammai. So the very, very well-known story is the convert comes to Shammai and says, teach me the entirety of the Torah on one foot, right? And Shammai, right, so kicks him out of the Beis Medrash, right? He pushes him away and says, right, so not on my watch, right? And, right, they said, right, the system has integrity and you're making a mockery of it. Right, and there's an element of truth to Shammai's position. Hillel, on the other hand, accepts these converts. Right, the first one wants to accept the written Torah without the oral Torah, and Hillel nonetheless accepts this individual. Now think about that. Imagine if a convert came nowadays and said to the rabbis, "I just want to follow Chumash," right? But the whole like Gemara thing, I'm not right. Shulchan Aruch, not so interested. Right, wouldn't go very far. And by the way, the commentaries struggle with this because is it really true that Hillel was accepting a convert without fundamental commitment to mitzvot? So some who want to push away and say, like Daniel Hartman, they cite this Gemara's. And others say, wait a second, the Gemara, if you jump for a second, to source 12, the Gemara says explicitly that if a Gentile heathen is prepared to accept the Torah with the exception of even one law in the Torah, and then the Gemara says, quotes Rabbi Yehuda, even if the exception be one point of the special minutia of the scribes' enactments, and there's a halacha midrabanan, just pure rabbinic law, right, we can't accept this convert. So I said before, accepting halachic standards. Again, how do you determine that? But so Hillel seems to be outright contradicting this. So are there two different rabbinic traditions? Is there a tradition in the Gemara and Shabbat which is more lenient and accepting, and the tradition in Bechorah which is more stringent? Or, right, and there are other Gemara which also seem more stringent. Or is the point that Hillel understood that sometimes if we embrace someone, we can be confident that ultimately they'll have a certain kind of commitment if we engage them in the right way? Not every kid who comes, or every person or prospective convert, comes with tough talk necessarily, you know. But on the other hand, you have Ruth's concern, right? We do need to maintain standards, and this needs to be a rigorous process, and we can't just have it be an open door policy. Anyone who wants to call themselves that is, that's it. There has to be integrity of the process. That's the struggle.
Didn't the Karaites force the issue? Because here was a group that said, we reject the oral law, we only accept the written law.
Right.
But yet they were kept outside of mainstream Judaism.
Yeah. A convert to... I mean, the Karaites were generally considered Jewish, right, because they were born... Right, there weren't yichus issues with the Karaites, and they maintained generally very purist and strict, you know, regulations in terms of these things. So that wasn't so much the issue, but the question of whether they were viewed as bona fide Jews... That was a major issue. There were minor issues in terms of converts to Karaism. That was an issue. Not at this time so much. That's more of a medieval issue. But you have that a little bit around the edges as well.
Well, I think the key to, if I may say, the key to Hillel is the go study.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of sequence. Mm-hmm. That he's ready to accept the convert because
immature,
of his will,
right?
And then, but says, "Go study,"
right,
rather than other people who seem to say, "No, you really have to study and do first, and then we'll convert."
Good. So, just to frame the issue, 100%. Yeah, gotcha. Just to frame the issue, so we can kind of come to a close here, and then pick up in 2 weeks' time. We have this apparent tension. We have some Gemarot that say that we need to be concerned or wary of sometimes the ramifications for our community, and sort of it's, it creates difficulty for the Jewish community to have that sort of piece of the tradition. And then be on top, layered on top of that, you have this strict tradition in terms of, well, even if a prospective convert rejects even a single rabbinic enactment, right, they're no longer candidates for acceptance for conversion. On the other hand, you have the Gemara about Hillel, where the Gemara clearly is siding with Hillel against Shammai and saying that we should have more embracing policies, it would seem. Right? They say, teach me the, you know, I'll only accept the written law. That's fine, we'll get to the oral law later on, we'll figure that out, right? You can say the whole Torah on one foot, fine, I'll teach you v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, that which is unpleasant to your friend, to you, don't do to your friends. Says, and the rest of it you'll go study. So we're gonna get there. Right, similar, you have a Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? Last verse we'll talk about today, bottom of 11, where it says, you know, that apropos, it says, what's the purpose of writing? It says, this seemingly obscure pasuk in Parsha Vayishlach says, on the top of page 13 now, that Lotan's sister was Timna, that was the page, right? So who cares? The Gemara says that Timna was a royal princess, etc., and then desiring, fourth line down on that page, desiring to become a proselyte, she went to Avram Yitzchak Yaakov. They did not accept her. She went to, became a concubine to Eliphaz, right? And that's the beginning of the story of Amalek. That's the first story.
So,
which one is it? And there's the tension. You want integrity of the Jewish community? That's fine. I'll show you integrity of the Jewish community because the people are on the outs, so you're going to become your mortal enemies. So these are really the tensions. And the question of how to resolve these different sort of strands in the tradition becomes one of the fundamental questions about the standards in today's world. And next time what I want to do is to then take this and then explore sort of halachically, is acceptance of mitzvot necessary? Is it not necessary? What constitutes acceptance of mitzvot? How do we handle that kind of issue? We're going to start to see contemporary authorities about that question, and that's going to help us to transition to see this in a practical halachic way as well. So that's going to be the next step. I look forward to seeing everyone 2 weeks' time. Looking forward as always.
Join next week.